Good evening, everybody. There were a few questions. I will deal with those first. One referring to the Song of Life, with which I am not familiar, I will not handle. What is Raja Yoga? Well, it's a technical form of yoga, akin to, but different from, Hatha Yoga, dealing primarily with certain psychic processes and to some extent with physical processes. It's more to be regarded as in the nature of an aid rather than being one of the fundamental trimarga, which are the routes of knowledge, love, and action, or will. Is there such a thing as integral yoga? Well, I believe so. That, of course, is, as probably all of you know, a term particularly associated with the name of Sri Aurobindo. The idea being that it is not sufficient or quite comprehensive to reach the goal by one way alone, but to follow the threefold path of the Trimarga, either simultaneously or in succession. How successful that has been, I do not know. There's nothing certainly wrong with the idea. Now, is Aurobindo what you would consider enlightened? Well, I would. It is just an accident that I didn't mention him last night. I so regard him. I would not attempt to measure his stature or that of any other Illuminati. For after all, when the tops of mountains are above the clouds, it's useless to try to determine how high the peaks are relatively. Usually, when one says that such and such a being is the greatest of them all, and of course it would be the one who is particularly close to him, he's reflecting ego. My God, my teacher, my guru. Emphasizing that, and this is the greatest of all, is in the nature of a form of subtle egoism. Do not attempt to measure the height of those who transcend earthly vision. It is enough that any one of them can illumine the way. That covers that. There's one other question here. What is there which is not either A or not A? The whole of enlightenment. And that's the simple answer. This denial that that which you seek is either the A or the not A means that the dualistic consciousness cannot comprehend it, that it falls outside those limitations. Our universes of discourse is still on the board. are valid only within the limits of the dualistic consciousness. That's the point there. Now you say, I cannot imagine another consciousness, something else. Yes, that's perfectly true. How could the limited dualistic consciousness imagine the non-dualistic? The road there is by realization. And after realization, you know. Before realization, you do not know. Do not try, therefore, to define that which lies beyond. Definition applies validly within the realm of dualistic consciousness. But our concepts are not made for that which lies beyond. And only by artful use of them can they even suggest something of that. And he goes on to continue his question. Is not even matter fluidic? Now, this is a question that calls for many counter questions. And this could take us into deep waters. What do you mean by matter? Do you mean a convenient hypothesis for uniting in a concept, for a concept uniting the impressions that come to you through the senses? Or are you hypostasizing this that you know through the senses? Touch, sight, sound, pressure, kinesthetic tension. Those are the things I know. Are you hypostasizing that and mean by matter something that exists externally, beyond all consciousness in every sense, a non-conscious somewhat? If you do, how do you know it? You know it. What you know are these impressions. That's all. Now, I did not yesterday mention the word matter. I mentioned two functions or organs or faculties of cognition, namely sense perception and conceptual cognition. We're familiar with these contents. That we know. But do they give us messages of a somewhat which lies beyond all consciousness? Oh, it's our habit to so regard them. But that's careless thinking. And when you come to reading the Buddha Sutras, if you do, you'll find that they're very exacting on that. You'll find the Buddha at least represented as saying, the qualities are all we have. And by the qualities, he means that which you actually experience. And there is no more. When you speak of a substance that is not itself experience in which those qualities inhere, you're not rigorous. That you do not know. It's a careless habit. This question could take us into deep and rough waters. And I have intended to to deal with the problem involved here later, after there's been more preparation. For you're dealing with a question that has occupied philosophers for many years. And as a matter of fact, the fully informed modern scientist makes no metaphysical projection of an idea of matter. I'm speaking of the really intelligent scientists, not the mere scientific clerks that work on problems. I mean men like Einstein, Vandeveer Bush, for instance, know that that which they deal with is only a certain set of determinations, largely capable of only mathematical formulation. From their experience, they project certain hypotheses that seem to integrate these experiences in a conceptual whole. Those hypotheses are good if they lead to further experiments or further observations that are predicted by the hypothesis and so confirmed. They fail if they do not so confirm. A theoretical physicist that I knew said what is obviously true to any mathematician, that there's a potential infinity of possible explanations of all the phenomena that we have. I can illustrate the point again from a mathematical reference. One of the simplest examples in the history of science, one of the most beautiful, was Kepler's determination from the observations of Tycho Brahe that the planets in their paths around the sun followed fairly closely the path of an ellipse. And this could be a paradigm for all building of hypotheses. You determine certain points. Let those points represent observations, classified observations. I'm going to put down five of them. In his case, being a spatial determination, that was pretty precisely what he did. Now, if you know your conic sections or the equations of the second degree, which consist of a circle, ellipse, parabola, hyperbola, and two intersecting lines. It is a fact that any five points determine uniquely any conic section. And in his case, these observations, along with others, that did so determine a path. Not as extreme as that. Of course, with the planets, it is not a path, as it is not an ellipse of such eccentricity. They're almost more nearly circular. But that illustrates the point. Let your equation represent your connecting hypothesis, your postulated interpretation. If you set the restriction that it must be a curve of the second degree, five points will give you a unique determination. But why should you set that restriction with respect to your observations, changing our figure now to any observations in a scientific problem? Might it not be that the true explanation would be in the form of a higher plane curve, higher than second degree, those higher than second degree, those of third, fourth, fifth, on to the nth degree, are infinitely numerous. And there'd be literally an infinity of curves that would pass through those points representing observation. And thus, theoretically, it is possible to have a hypothetical explanation or theory explain the facts of scientific determination. The scientists also impose a certain arbitrary rule upon hypotheses that is not required by the necessities of logic itself. And that is that the hypothesis shall be of such a nature that it shall lead to suggested experiments or observations for further checking. It's known as the operational requirement. But have we any certainty that ultimate truth is of such a nature that we can check it by our methods within the dualistic consciousness? What we do have in science is a pragmatic test of truth, and not a test of truth per se. And by pragmatic, I simply mean that it works. That these hypotheses lead to experiences that can be predicted. That if you put your foot down on the starter in the automobile, the motor will turn over. Something you predicted came true. In a practical, pragmatic sense, you've checked it. That's all. That the truth that works within the realm of dualistic consciousness is by no means necessarily the true truth, the truth as it is in itself. Now, a man like Einstein is fully aware of this and has said so. And one of the men that he most admired was Sir Isaac Newton, the man whose philosophic concept of the nature of the cosmos he overthrew. He's a step beyond Newton in that Newton still believed in metaphysical existences and introduced them into his hypothesis. He had a conception of an absolute time moving through space evenly, which on examination has no meaning practically. Many of his laws work. They still work for our experiences within the megascopic range. But they are no longer valid, and we know them to be no longer valid when we deal with velocities approaching that of light or with determinations on a great cosmic scale, determinations far vaster than were possible in Newton's time. So Einstein said, what Newton did was give the first approximation to the truth. And what I've added in the light of a greater experience in the field of science is only a second approximation. And others may follow later with other changes. He had the conception that here was an infinite series of steps, of which these were the first two, approaching truth. There you have the modesty of the really great scientific mind, one who knows the limitations of his own methods. One of the most significant things in the step from Newton to Einstein is that now epistemology enters into the picture. The ways that we have of determining fact, like a light signal from a star, condition the form of the knowledge. The knowledge is thus relative to the limitations of our knowing process. That's a vast maturity over the earlier integration. It was not possible back in the time of Newton, for we had not yet awakened to the limitations of the knowing process with which we deal, as we have since. We're locked within this dualistic system, within the limits of a limited way means of cognition. As I said, two arms of cognition, sense perception and conceptual cognition. Cognition that moves in terms of concepts having certain character. And now that was all I talked about last night. I never mentioned matter. And when I spoke of the realm below the line that I put upon the board, and I identified it with granular consciousness, or with the manifold of individual elements, each of which could be next to the other, like the number system, considering only the natural numbers, and use the concept of the continuum to represent that which is above the line, beyond dualistic consciousness. I made only an approximation. Only an approximation to the truth, for after all, this continuum is granular also. Again, marked by the limitations of our cognitive process. When our granules get pretty small, they actually become infinitely small and are called infinitesimal. At least that is the concept left by Leibniz. And at least in my day, that was the form that the calculus took. We dealt with the notion of infinitely small grains, literally infinitely small, that make up the parts of the continuum. But since they're grains, it is not pure flow. Now the mathematicians haven't ever been content or really satisfied with the idea of something, an existent that is infinitely small, small below, beyond all measure. And it is said that Weir Strauss disposed of the infinitesimal for all time. He is rated as the greatest of the analytic thinkers. A man that you might be interested in, because he looks like a poet, and this remark has been attributed to him, the mathematician, who is not also something of a poet, is not a complete mathematician. And you get perhaps here a little of the feel of the mathematician. I'll give you a little more of it as we go on. He got rid, so they say, of the infinitesimal, but at a price. The price is the denial that there is any such thing as motion. But all we have is bodies occupying points in space, stationary, corresponding to points in time. Now, it works. You can build a calculus on that basis, all right. I have not seen the analysis. It was not taught in our calculus in my day. We followed the line of Leibniz, in which you tend to regard infinitely small entities as, in some sense, real entities. Now, you can get rid of those infinitesimals at the price of abandoning the notion that there is any such thing as motion. But only bodies occupying different points in space, corresponding to different points in time. Your intuition might say, well, how could it get to the different point without moving there? It's found it's unnecessary to make any use of that intuition. All you need to do is to consider motion as merely, it's what we call motion, as merely matter stationarily, or bodies stationarily occupying different points in space at different points in time. You might call it the cinematographic view of reality. And the idea, and that the idea of motion is simply an illusion or maya. Now, I'm not championing this point of view. I'm merely presenting it. I'm standing neutral at present. Now, we do know it's possible to use a series of stationary images that'll produce an illusion of motion. Every time you go to a moving picture, that happens. Every image that is thrown upon the screen is completely stationary. Merely they're thrown on very rapidly, and you get a sense of flow or motion, but there is none there. Again, there was a Greek philosopher by the name of Parmenides who long ago maintained there was no such thing as motion. His counter number was Heraclitus, who said, there's so much motion, you can't step into the same stream twice, nor even after all, once. And Zeno, who was said to be a disciple of Parmenides, developed his paradoxes for the very purpose of showing that if you conceived of such a thing as motion, you got into trouble. Thus, in the famous paradox of the Archimedes and the turtle, you give the turtle a head start. Now, he says, Archimedes can never catch that turtle, no matter how slowly the turtle goes or how fast Archimedes travels. For, say Archimedes, or not Archimedes, Achilles, starts at this point, and the turtle is over at this point. Achilles has to get through this point before he can catch the turtle. But meanwhile, the turtle has gone on. And he has to get to that point before he can catch him. The turtle is meanwhile going on. And that goes on indefinitely. And there'd be an infinite number of steps. And he couldn't possibly consummate an infinite number of steps in finite time. Therefore, there is no motion. Now, you may laugh at it, but logicians and mathematicians have wrestled with that problem for 2,000 years. And they're not completely satisfied with the resolution of it yet. There are some real difficulties in this thinking process of ours. Bertrand Russell thought it could be resolved by the idea that you could pass over an infinite number of steps by a finite time, because the sum of an infinite number of steps is not necessarily infinite, but may be finite. That may be the resolution, but they had to wait to our day if it is. So don't laugh at Zeno. He put it in humorous form. But it was a very critical problem in thought. Now, tonight I was going to go into the mathematical side of things a bit. But first I want to say there, as to my plan in lectures, I try to unite the systematic with the spontaneous. The systematic is that which is normal to ordinary intellectual organization. It's what you get in the professor's lecture right along. It's the sort of thing you can do, and know you can do it, beforehand. It merely takes work. So, I regard anything that's purely systematic as merely a detail, because you can say, this I will turn out at such and such a time, and I'll produce it at such and such a time, and you can deliver. But the spontaneous is that which comes from out, from beyond the cell, from above that line, and that you cannot, from the power, through the powers that lie below, say, this I shall deliver. It comes as a bestowal, if it comes at all. And when it comes, all that belongs to the systematic is cast aside, and this takes over. To maintain the two in operation is a complex problem. It may mean that you abandon all plans that you have had for a lecture, even at the moment of coming in. And that has happened to me. In stepping from the door to the platform, I dropped everything and spoke a totally different subject without any plan beforehand. And that means for an hour at a time, organization going on in the very process of delivery. Now, you may predict that such may happen. You cannot say, this I shall do. When it does happen, there is a certain phenomenon. By phenomenon, I mean features that are recognizable, detectable, at least by some people. The consciousness beyond the line or veil appears here as a field consciousness. And it may be sensed as a something like a deepening, as a palpable silence filled with unformed meaning. It may take over the guidance of conceptual construction. And if it does, it does so with a sure hand. And one can do that which in his ordinary capacity he cannot do. It can evoke in those in the vicinity states of the mystic sort, ecstatic states of consciousness, states of delight. It can produce an experience of heat. This is not well explained in my mind as yet, but it happens. Make no mistake about that. I've seen faces become red, perspiration roll down the faces, and people take their coats off. Effects can be that tangible. And one may speak words that are instructions to himself as well as to others. What is the source of this knowledge? There's more than one. In part, it may be the deeper knowledge of that unseen part of one. It may be the knowledge of the brotherhood. For that brotherhood is a many in one. Not a separated, granular structure, but a whole that may be represented in this way of the I becoming we and yet remaining I. And above and beyond this, a knowledge that is not the possession of any self. A knowledge that does not require a knower, but is a sort of universal storehouse. And this is power to mold the consciousness of man, to make nearer, to bring nearer the opening above. So whenever this impinges, takes primacy over everything else. But it may be here for a time and then may go. I return to the systematic at such times. It is not the private work of one who speaks. It is the joint work of the speaker and the audience. It does not happen in the presence of a hostile audience or of an audience that is all question mark. What does this guy think he's got, for instance? But it depends upon an inner rapport. It may take time to build that rapport, but it can happen. The states can be very deep, even as deep as waking samadhi. Now, this is a little glimpse of something of the beyond. The first, that it may mean to the relative consciousness as it glimpses into those depths is as though it were a darkness, silence, and emptiness, but shifting to its own level, to another way of cognition. It is known as the intensest light, outer fullness, and the acme of meaning. Meaning being the inner essence of sound. Actually, it's here now. Now, I said we'd. I think I said that we'd come to something of definitions. We can shift over. What is mathematics? You know, my subject is mathematics, philosophy, and yoga. There's a reason for that combination. Is the path I'm in. And therefore the one I know best. Now you look in different dictionaries as I did. We get very many different definitions of what is meant by mathematics. I looked up in the old century, and it said, mathematics is the science of quantity. Well, I suppose that's a popular idea. But it's very far from the truth. There's much of mathematics that has nothing to do with quantity. As, for instance, the algebra of logic. The development of the great Irish mathematician, Boole. And concerning whom Bertrand Russell said that he was the first of the pure mathematicians. Algebra of logic is not concerned with quantity. It's concerned with classes, sets. Concepts like that. Relationships. Another branch that is not quantitative, and incidentally a very beautiful one, is projective geometry. I thought you might be interested in one of the propositions here. In projective geometry, there's no metrical property whatsoever. No measurement. And where quantity is considered, measurement is fundamental. But these propositions are descriptive. Unfortunately, I do not have something good for drawing lines. But now let us draw at random. Any line. And any other line. We call them L prime. Now at random we put 3 points on each line, any place whatsoever. We call these points A, B, C on L. A prime, B prime, and C prime, and L prime. We draw a line between A and B prime. And a line between A prime and B. Note that part there. Draw a line between B and C prime. Remember, these points and lines are taken at random. No measurement at all. Now we draw a line from C to A prime. And from C time to A. And the theorem is, and this is proven, those three points lie on a straight line. To the mathematician, that's beautiful. Not because of what you see with the eye, because of its massive unexpectedness. That was proven by Pascal originally. It's a special case of a larger theorem dealing with the conic sections. But your point is, these lines are random. They're infinitely long. All lines in projective geometry are infinitely long. You know, because there's no measurement at all involved. There's no consideration of size of angle. Your points are taken completely at random, any place you want to put them on the lines. You draw these, and you get the three on one line. Now, there is in that, if you can get it, something of the experience of beauty that appeals to the mathematician. It's a conceptual beauty. It's the very bringing together into a kind of unity of elements that seemed separate, unconnected. There are many such experiences, usually realized only at a high level of concentration, that can produce effects that are definitely ecstatic. More complete, more adequate as a definition of mathematics is the one that is found in Baldwin's Dictionary of Philosophy and Psychology, namely, that mathematics is the science of abstract relationships. Williamson, in his contribution to the 9th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, says any conception which is completely determined by a finite number of specifications is a mathematical conception. And here's one I do not remember as well, but Bertrand Russell. Pure mathematics is the class of all propositions of the form P implies Q, where P and Q are propositions containing variables the same in both propositions, and no constants except logical constants. I imagine that for many of you, the conception of mathematics is somewhat different from what you formerly thought. Oh, yes, but returning to the non-metrical forms of mathematics, besides the algebra of logic and this projective geometry, there is a form that's known as rubber sheet geometry. You study what relationships remain constant if you assume your plane is being distorted in any way whatsoever. You could distort it in such a way that a square would be made into a circle or an ellipse or any other figure. What remains constant? the order of parts remains constant. And that is a subject of considerable importance. Another name for rubber sheet geometry is topology. There you can have funny experiences. Like a ring that has only one side. Oh, I wish I'd put one together and brought it here. One side being... the point being that you can put a pencil without lifting it, make it go around on this sheet of paper, put running down the center, and it'll, without lifting it, you'll find it'll go clear around and runs into itself. So it's a ring with only one side. Now, these are some of the queer things that men do investigate. And some of these are by far from being a matter of quantity. Then we come to the question beyond definition of what is the essential nature of mathematics. And in this there are three well-recognized schools. One is known as the logicists, of which Bertrand Russell is the best known name, who say mathematics is only logic. And the ideal that they have in mind is that by a purely logical process, one that you could program a machine for, you could turn out all mathematics that is and all that will ever be discovered in the future. But it hasn't been done. And it runs into difficulties. Or you run into some varied, severe paradoxes. And here's one for you, if you can work with it. Consider the class of all classes which are not members of themselves. Is that class a member of itself? Study it. If you don't, get dizzy. That question and proposition was sent to a certain Italian, I think it was Piano, who had just finished, I think it was a 2-volume work on mathematical logic. It was in the press. And that question invalidated his whole thesis. He said it's a hard thing after you've put years into scientific investigation to have the whole tower fall in one moment. You'll find that you can't say yes and you can't say no to that question. Now, there is a paradox in that that has grown out of this. Very view of the nature of mathematics. I'm wondering if you're not trying to make it a bit too pure. A purity, when I speak of it as purity in this sense, it particularly involves elimination of intuition. Reducing it to a logical process that has no more use for intuition, no more need of it. Now, there's another school, particularly connected with the name of Hilbert, which is called the formalistic school. Now, the story here, not connected with logic in the sense that it was the case with Russell, but with a story of the extraordinary forms of geometry. I wonder, I'm getting at something here in all of this. To many of you, you won't see the point. But we're learning something about the powers and the limitations of pure thought. And it's precisely in mathematics that we find pure thought. And that's why I think it's worth your while, even though you do not have a mathematical background, to get some of this. And also be a bit prepared for some possible adversaries. When Euclid wrote his geometry, he had a number of propositions which he called axioms. And axioms were defined as self-evident truths, something everybody would agree was true. And then from that he started up, tried to deduce all the rest from those. One of those axioms seemed awfully complex, known as the 12th axiom. It ran something, is known also as the parallel axiom. Something like this. If the sum of these two interior angles on the same side of a transversal crossing two lines equal two right angles, then these lines will not meet. Now that looks like a theorem, something you have to prove. Actually, it's an axiom. In your present books, if you have study Euclid anymore, I don't know whether you do. You probably find it in this form. Through a point in a plane, you can draw one and only one line parallel to a given line. That's the form it takes today. That was the form Euclid left it in. Many mathematicians tried, since it looked like a theorem, tried to prove it from the other axioms, but with complete failure. And the next step was to see if you could assume something different. Lobachevsky and Boinier, independently I believe, assume that to a given line you can draw through a point two parallel lines. That is, in other words, neither of these lines will touch that line short of infinity. Assumed it. Now, it doesn't look like it. That isn't the point. Can you then logically, with that axiom, build up a geometry that is self-consistent? The answer is yes. It was done. Many things, every proposition in Euclid that depends upon this 12th axiom, so-called, will be different in this geometry. Among other things, you're familiar with the statement that the sum of the interior angles of a triangle is always equal to two right angles. In this geometry, it's always greater than two right angles. Another man independently, Riemann, and this is particularly important, assume that you could not draw any line to a point that would be parallel, that any line would meet the given line in a finite distance. That instead of meeting at infinity, would meet in a finite distance. And thus, and in that geometry, every line, straight line now, followed in that direction, will lead you back into it this way. Well, that isn't according to your intuition, but there's no logical failure in that geometry either. It's self-consistent. Now, in mathematics, according to Russell, any conception exists which is self-consistent. Therefore, Riemann and Lobachevsky in geometry exist. About 50 years after Riemann, Einstein came along and developed his general theory of relativity and found that the Riemann geometry fit his conception of the cosmos. And so Einstein asked, how is it possible that the mathematician thinking in his ivory tower thinks what is true of the universe outside? Nice question. A pure mathematician. Now remember, Riemann is a pure mathematician. He's interested in this intellectual exercise. In a way, you can say he's doing it for the fun of it. Every pure mathematician does that. Pure mathematician is like the gods. He does nothing because it's his duty. He does it because for the fun of it. That's the way the free souls always are. And there's a good deal of that freedom illustrated in the mathematician. There's no duties for the free soul. He does what he does spontaneously. But what he does spontaneously accomplishes the best result. So, the pure mathematician goes into the ivory tower. And he thinks for the fun of it. And then someone else comes along, takes his product, and finds that it gives you a control over some department of nature. And about that time, the pure mathematician gets sore. His beloved purity is now corrupted by use. There is the story of a mathematician who had an idea that seemed far out, and he said, I thank God there's no conceivable use of this thing. And now, is that so strange? An artist makes a beautiful picture. And somebody comes along and uses it for selling coke. How does the artist feel? Well, that's the way the pure mathematician feels. We're not all made over the same pattern. And here's a fact. Turn it over. Here's a fact. I don't know. Sure you're not erasing? That which is... I forget when I lost what I was going to say. That happens. Oh, yes. Here's the fact. Practically all of mathematical creation has been done by the pure mathematician sitting in his ivory tower. And it is well known that if you try to produce for a use, you don't produce. The one great exception to that was Sir Isaac Newton's development of the theory of fluxions, which is another name for the calculus. His interest was in the cosmic conception, and mathematics for him was only a tool. And the same need also be said about the mathematics of Wiener in our own day, one of the chief theoreticians behind the development of the computer, that he did not have the pure mathematical orientation, but an applied one. Now, let us look at this. Oh, here's a story. This involves what, at least in my day, was the greatest of the Indian mathematicians, East Indian, Rasmussen, I think, and Hardy, an English mathematician. They were both of the pure type. Hardy tells in one of his lectures of going in a cab to visit this Indian mathematician when he was in England. And when he came in, he said, The number on my cab was 1728. A very dull number. But the Indian friend said, no, on the contrary, it's a very interesting number. For it is the smallest number. That is the sum of two cubes in two ways. Now, I'll leave with you the problem of finding those two cubes in two ways. You know, a liberated soul doesn't work. He only plays. His action is a spontaneous expression of delight. But out of that come the greatest creations of all. I didn't finish up what I was going to say. Let's see what our time is. A little few more minutes, if you can stand it. On the development that led to the formalists. When this new development on Euclidean geometry took place, it was in effect a revolution in the whole conception of the nature of mathematics. The whole idea of the axiom went overboard, of an innate idea, of the innate ideas that are natural upon which your logical constructions were made. And in place of them, we have substituted what are called only fundamental assumptions. Ultimately, that led to the formulation of all sorts of extraordinary geometry. And there's an example of one here. And those of you who know your Euclid may not perhaps recognize this. We have as our fundamental assumptions, first, if A and B are distinct elements of S, there's at least one L class containing both A and B. Axiom 2, if A and B are distinct elements of S, there is not more than one L class containing both A and B. Axiom 3, any two L classes have at least one element of S in common. 4, there exists at least one L class in S. 5. Every L class contains at least three elements of S. Axiom 6. All the elements of S do not belong to the same L class. 7. No L class contains more than three elements of S. Now, here's an application of this geometry. Let us suppose a banking firm with seven partners. In order to assure themselves of expert information concerning various securities, they decide to form seven committees, each of which will study a special field. They agree, moreover, that each partner will act as chairman of one committee, and that every partner will serve on three and only three committees. The following is the schedule of committees and their members, the first member being chairman. Domestic Railroads, Adams, Brown, Smith. Municipal Bonds, Brown, Murphy, Ellis. Federal Bonds, Murphy, Smith, Jones. South American Securities, Smith, Ellis, Gordon. Domestic Steel Industry, Ellis, Jones, Adams. Continental Securities, Jones, Gordon, Brown. Public Utilities, Gordon, Adams, Murphy. Shades of Euclid. That's what modern geometry has become. In other words, that combination fits that. Geometry used to mean earth measurement. No longer is a proper term. Now, the formalists say mathematics is a game, playing with formal entities that don't mean anything but which you play seriously, like chess. We'll take up next time the intuitionless conception of Spengler and then my own. We haven't gotten as far today as I expected. So we rise and say our words. Let there be peace within the universe. Let the power of the warriors of light be made manifest. Let wisdom guide us and love protect us throughout our lives. Peace be with you. See you tomorrow night.